It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the man who endeared himself to a generation of control freaks. 20 years ago, Harold McGee started empowering cooks with his consummate work on kitchen science, on food and cooking. Well, now he's got a 21st century edition packed with new discoveries. Well, the Stearns have discovered Great Cajun in the middle of nowhere, D.I.'s in Bazille, Louisiana. The New York Times gift guru, Marion Burroughs, reports on her best of the best mail order picks. We have a report on the black market for Swiss night milk. We get the backstory on this year's blockbuster food book. And then it's tradition, the history of keeping kosher. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today we talk with Harold McGee, the man who took food science out of the lab and put it in the home kitchen. 20 years ago, his book on food and cooking became an instant classic. Well, now he tells us what's new in his completely updated 21st century edition. Marion Burroughs of New York Times fame has tasted, tested for a year to bring us her top picks in mail order. Lisa Stern explains the origins of keeping kosher. Our intrepid reporter Scott Haas has the scoop on Switzerland's latest, the subversive night milk. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get things started the way we do every week with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by Starbucks, collecting books and toys at neighborhood locations for this year's Holiday Angels Joy Drive. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So guys, are you going to be heading to any place that's warm, you think, maybe?
Does Louisiana count?
Oh, it sure does. Absolutely.
Warm and humid, always.
Where are you going?
Well, actually, we found this restaurant courtesy of a friend of Michael's whose name is Manny. And Manny is the sheriff in Sulphur, Louisiana. He's a Cajun boy, and he took us to D.I.'s, which is on Highway 97 in Basil. Is that how
Basile.
They... Basile, Louisiana.
And I have to wait. I have to interject and say that Highway 97 through Basile, Louisiana is a road that no one would ever go on unless they were headed for DIs or if they live there.
Why not? And unless you knew Manny.
And we would never, as Jane said, we found this place. We never, ever would have found it if Manny hadn't said, if you're looking for real Cajun food, I know the place to eat it. And he's the one who took us to DIs.
Is this like a dirt road or something?
I think it's paved, but barely so.
There's kind of nothing on it. Uh-huh. And we had such a great time at DI's. I mean, their specialty is crawfish, obviously, and frog legs and flounder and shrimp and, you know, just brilliantly spiced. And they have a band playing and you get cold beers to wash it down. And Manny was so proud of us for not acting like Northerners. He said, you know, for Sterns, you're practically Thibodeaux, which was sort of his
highest compliment.
So this is real. This is what, when they talk about Cajun food, this is the stuff. Do they do the etouffee kind of thing and all that stuff?
They do have etouffee, but really the great thing to order, especially if it's, you know, in the spring, is crawfish, boiled crawfish, which are served as is appropriate on a great big beer tray, just a heap of them. And you have to know, if fortunately we had Manny there to help us, you know, to do that, you know, sort of head sucking and tail sucking that you have to do to get out all the juicy
fat
out of the crawfish. I know it doesn't sound great, but I tell you, it's delicious.
Is this sort of a local bar?
Yes, it is. It's a local bar / restaurant. Slash dance hall. And, you know, the music is like pure Cajun music, real Zydeco type stuff.
And everybody brings their extended families. I mean, this is not, you know, kind of a dark, sleazy bar where you would go.
It's a party.
Yeah, it's a party. It's the way Cajuns live. You know, the whole family comes, and it's a big party, and it is delicious food, and truly unknown. I mean, Michael and I have never heard about this place before.
Where exactly is this in Louisiana?
It's north of Interstate 10, about maybe 30 or 40 miles.
That's not helping, Michael.
Well, okay.
It's between New Orleans and Sulphur, Louisiana.
And we all know Sulphur. Maybe halfway between New Orleans and Lake Charles, maybe 25, 30 miles north of I-10. And that's about as close as my GPS mind is going to get you.
But you know, one of the original road food rules of the road was, when you're in a small town, ask the local cop where to eat. Mm-hmm. So this really does prove that theory to be true. And Manny is a good old boy. He's a big boy, and he's a Harley-Davidson rider.
And a good eater.
And a good eater.
But you give our best to Manny, and thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn. When you see me,
somewhere in a Creole town, start to let me show you your way around.
Stearns are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they are here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And speaking of road food, we're heading out to dig into Italian road food this spring. We're taking a trip to the Emilia-Romagna region of Italy. And you can come, too. You can find details, well, you know, on the website, splendidtable.org. Tis the time of year when there should be an 11th commandment. Thou shalt not shop with thy fellow man. Instead, mail order. Ah, but then you hit the great mail order conundrum. How do you know if the stuff is any good? Well, we have Marion Burroughs to the rescue. Food expert and columnist for the New York Times, Marion spends her year checking out scores of mail order foods and gadgets. She publishes her top picks every November in the Times. Marion, good to have you back with us.
It's delightful to be with you.
How long have you been doing this?
Well, I knew you were going to ask that, and I should have really looked it up, because it's 23 or 22 years. A long time.
So with all of that, anything new under the sun for you, or do you just get kind of, there we go again?
Well, you know, after a while, it does get a little bit harder, but there is always something new under the sun. And this year, there are at least three amazing, wonderful under the sun things.
Like what? Like what?
Well, one of them is fresh Alaskan king salmon in the middle of winter. Even though the big season is way, way over by that time, there can be a certain kind of fishing that's allowed with a line.
Uh-huh.
And fishermen go out to the Yakutat Peninsula, I'm sure I'm pronouncing it wrong, in southeastern Alaska, and they catch that succulent king salmon. Now, it's extremely pricey. It's sort of up there with foie gras, but I think in many ways it's better than foie gras.
Now, is it shipped frozen or is it shipped?
No, it's shipped fresh. That's the height of luxury to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so succulent and it has such a wonderful taste. People just rave over it. So that is my big gift. It's my Neiman Marcus gift of the of the year. And it's $209 for 5 pounds, and that includes the shipping. A lot of money, worth every penny.
Mm-hmm. Now, what other picks?
My cheapest gift is one that I now have two of, one for where I live in New York and one for where I live in Washington. It's a latte frother. It's called the Primo Frother, and it's meant for people who like cappuccino or mocha. And it has two AA batteries, and you could carry it in your handbag, and you can froth up your own topping. I like it, and I know this sounds ridiculous, to froth up skim milk, and then I eat the milk with a little flavoring, coffee flavoring.
So
I do it at my desk, and, you know, well, never mind. If you've been at the paper as long as I have, they're just going to have to take you the way you are. That only costs $20.
This sounds great.
Then this is... it's wonderfully bizarre. Only in New York would you find a shop that sells only rice pudding and makes a go of it. And this place is called Rice to Riches, and they are now selling rice pudding in a number of flavors. Now, this is sort of I guess I'd call it insanely rich. It ain't your mother's rice pudding, I'll tell you that.
What is it like?
It's nursery food for grown-ups. And a couple of my favorite flavors were, and they have funny names, Property of Lemon,
mm-hmm.
and then Poppy and an Endangered Maple. Or I guess my favorite and the most indulgent of all is Man-Made Mascarpone with Sun-Dried Cherries. A 40-ounce container serves 5 people and is $45, and that includes shipping from Rice to Riches.
This sounds... pretty luscious.
Pretty luscious. There are several other things, if we have time to mention a couple of other things.
Sure.
Just amazing. Someone I know in Washington whose day job is as a political consultant, she did fairly well this year, but not great, also makes cookies. It's her night job. And they're called Marla's Magic, and I haven't had one bad cookie from that woman. a gift box of 36 old favorites, for example, like caramel Graham's and oatmeal raisin is $40. Or two dozen brownies in triple chocolate, chocolate mint, toffee, and coffee is $45. And that's Marla's Magic.
Mm-hmm.
The best fruit conserves I have ever had, or fruit in syrup, from anybody ever, and I every year I for the last couple I've tried to get something new from her, is June Taylor Company in California. She does an apricot conserve and Santa Rosa plum, and then something's called sour cherries and eau de vie syrup. Oh, I can't rave enough about them. The problem is that whoever takes the first bite of taste of one of these is not going to let you have the jar back. They are just luscious. 8 ounces, $10 for the conserves. And the cherries in eau de vie syrup, 13 ounces for $25. And you could sort of have one cherry with a little of the syrup on top on your vanilla ice cream to make it from ordinary to extraordinary. And it would last a long time if you only took one cherry.
Marion, you've set us up. It's quite a list. Hey, thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Fat chance, one cherry. New York Times food columnist Marion Burroughs' mail order article appeared in the November 10th, 2004 issue of The Times. Now, Marion's latest book is Cooking for Comfort. Now, we think her macaroni and cheese recipe is ideal for right now. You can find it and her mail order picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Every week, we send you a recipe for a fast supper dish. We send along shopping and technique tips. And best of all, thanks to those cows, it's free. You can register for it online, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the man who won the hearts and minds of kitchen control freaks and sleeping tight with Swiss night milk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all-in-one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. In 1969, the distinguished British physicist Nicholas Curtie said, "I think it's a sad reflection of our civilization that while we can and do measure the temperature on Venus, we do not know what goes on inside of our souffles." Well, a young man who did his doctorate thesis on Keats and the progress of taste set out to change this state of affairs. In 1984, Harold McGee published On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. We'd never seen such a blockbuster on food science. It became the secret stash of every food pro. Now, after 20 years, McGee is giving us a new edition, On Food and Cooking, completely revised and updated. Harold McGee, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Lynn.
Harold, I have a confession to make. You have saved me from more embarrassment and more
disasters than any other man on the planet.
I'm delighted. I had no idea, but I'm delighted.
Oh, I think you've figured into the life of a lot of cooks. But now, I understand that you were teaching literature and cooking at Yale. How did you go from that to writing one of the great food science books of the last 50 years?
Well, I was teaching literature at Yale, and I was cooking. I wasn't teaching cooking. And the way it happened was entirely by accident. I didn't especially think I was a good cook, or in fact wasn't all that interested in cooking, mm-hmm. except to have something to eat every day. But I had friends both in literature departments and in science departments, and when we would all get together for a potluck dinner, sometimes we had to work a little bit to find a topic that we could all get interested in. And often that was food. And one evening, a friend of mine from New Orleans just asked the question, why is it that his favorite dish, red beans and rice, if he had more than two or three servings of it, would give him some suffering in two or three hours.
Uh-huh.
So the question of why beans give you gas was really the impetus to my writing that book, because I thought that was a wonderful question. And I just took a break from literature and went down to the biology library for a change and started poking around to see what I could find. And I found this wonderful stash of food science, food technology, which had been developed for the manufacturing industries, but was just unknown by the rest of us. And so I thought it would be fun to take that information and translate it into ordinary English and translate it into information that cooks, restaurant cooks, home cooks could take advantage of.
Do you think not being a scientist really helped make the book such a success? Because your work is so readable. I don't feel I have to have a science degree to understand it.
Well, that's it. I think it was an advantage for me not only not to be a scientist, but also not to be a professional cook, because I came to it completely naive, just, you know, with my eyes wide open and saying, wow, that's cool, or I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to capture some of that sense of delight as I wrote.
Well, now 20 years later, you've done a new edition, and you say it's mostly new material. How much did you have to scrap, and has the science actually changed?
Well, in some cases, it has changed. In many cases, it has simply accumulated. That is to say, it's progressed and evolved, and so there's more to say about some things. I would say that I've probably scrapped, I don't know, 75% or so of the original. Not in some cases, not because the information was incorrect, but because there are better ways to explain it these days. And also, you know, the readership has changed. Food in America has undergone such an explosion of interest and connoisseurship in the last 20 years that I really had to explain everything better this time around. And I think the better understanding people have of what's going on behind the scenes, the better they can make sense of what goes on when something unexpected happens and you have to recoup.
You know, I'd like to talk to you about a specific, you know, as an example. And one of the things you mention in the book is that to have a tender steak, we should keep turning it while we're cooking it. Why is that?
Well, it turns out that while you're cooking, say it's a steak in a pan, while the steak is cooking on one side, when that side is in contact with the hot pan, the other side is cooling down because it's facing room temperature air. And so one side gets very hot, the other side stays cold. Then you flip it, the hot side now begins to cool down, and the cold side begins to heat up. And it turns out that the longer you leave it on one side or the other, the more uneven the heating, and the more time there is to overcook one side and to undercook the other. So it turns out that the more frequently you flip a piece of meat, the faster it cooks, by maybe about 30%. It's a pretty substantial difference, and the more evenly it cooks.
Huh. Hey, Harold, you've created one of my favorite reference books, but what are your favorite reference books?
Well, I've got maybe three or four that I just turn to all the time.
Uh-huh.
One is Alan Davidson's Oxford Companion to Food, which is this immense tome, three columns per page, and it basically covers the world. Alan was just someone who, he just soaked up information and then squeezed it all out for us in this book, and it's a wonderful resource. For something much more practical, I turn to Anne Willen's La Varenne Pratique, which is also a big book with lots of pages. And its strength is that it covers most of the common preparations of foods in the European tradition and some in the Asian tradition as well. And pretty much any dish that you can think of that you would see in a restaurant, you can find an explanation of and often a recipe for in that book.
And the last...
And the book that most people won't find on the bookstore shelves is a book by Michael Doyle called Food Microbiology. And it's fairly technical, but the ideal resource for understanding two very important things. One is food safety, because it covers microbes. And the other is fermentations, which, you know, give us wine and cheese and bread and some of the most delicious foods that we eat.
Well, Harold, now I know where you go for information, but thanks for giving us on food and cooking. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lynn. My pleasure.
Harold McGee is author of the new edition of On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. Pick a belief system, and somewhere in it, you're going to find food. Ritual food, taboo food. Well, how did these concepts come about? Food writer Lisa Stern writes about the Jewish tradition of keeping kosher. Her book is How to Keep Kosher. Lisa, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. It's nice to be here.
You know, Lisa, we hear all about you don't eat milk with meat, you don't eat bacon, you don't eat shellfish. But how did keeping kosher come about? What's the historical foundation of it?
Well, the historical foundation is the Bible, the Old Testament, the five books of Moses, and that's where the basic laws of kashrut come from.
And kashrut is the
kashrut is the right, the Hebrew word for the practice of keeping kosher is called kashrut, which literally means fit or proper.
So were these actually like written down saying thou shalt not, you know, do all of these things?
Essentially, some were more explicit than other laws in the Torah. Specifically, not eating pork, not eating shellfish, that's spelled out explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
Some were subject to interpretation and were interpreted and defined in the Talmud. One of the basic laws of kashrut is not eating meat and milk, and that's based on a passage that appears three times in the Torah. And Bible interpretation, according to the Talmud, the way it, words appear in the Torah is very significant. And because this particular phrase appears exactly three times, there must be some significance to it. And the phrase is, you shouldn't boil a kid in its mother's milk. And there are a lot of elaborate laws that have been based on that, because what exactly did God mean? But there's sort of a humorous anecdote my friend Barbara Modell had recounted to me, which is that God came to the Jewish people. They were in the desert, Ten Commandments. They're getting the laws of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And the Jewish people said, you mean we shouldn't eat any meat and milk together? No cheeseburgers, no meat, glass of milk with hamburger.
This is in the desert.
This is in the desert. This is in the desert,
yeah, right.
Right,
okay.
And then God said, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And the Jews said, oh, you mean we should wait 6 hours after we have meat before we can have dairy, and we should wait an hour after we've hard cheese, and 5 minutes after milk. And God said, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And they said, oh, okay, we should have separate dishes for meat and milk, and separate pots and pans and silverware, everything separate. And God said, have it your way. So this is a humorous take on the complexity of kashrut, but that particular law, in fact, to me, has a very, the whole reason for keeping kosher is kind of spiritual. It's adding a spiritual element to something we do every day.
Do you think a lot of these laws also may have continued to be practiced because of health concerns? Because I'm thinking, I mean, the original climate of the Jewish people was the Middle East. It's very warm. Do you think that had a factor in there?
I think there are many people who think that. I mean, some of the rules are sort of you can't pinpoint exactly like what is the logic behind them. But some there is specifically parasites and diseases that could become from tainted meat.
Mm-hmm.
The sage Maimonides had commented that there was the logic behind this, that God was thinking of us and there are health reasons for not eating a lot of these foods.
Do the laws keep changing as foods change and as times change?
The basic laws don't change. That is, no meat and milk, no forbidden foods, and the meat consumed must be killed in a specific way. Those don't change. What changes is as food technology evolves. Kashrut is at the same time both easier and more complicated because you have monodiglycerides and additives and flavorings, and they're flavorings made from beaver glands, and beaver isn't kosher, and flavorings that
gets very complicated
comes from beetle skins, and you know, so it does, and you have to know what's what and what can and cannot be considered kosher.
Lisa Stern, thank you very much, and by the way, happy Hanukkah.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Lisa Stern is author of How to Keep Kosher. Now, to get Hanukkah rolling, Lisa left us with her husband's recipe for potato pancakes. You can find perfect potato latkes on the website, splendidtable.org. The Munchaceutical. Now, that's my name for food as medicine, an old concept that's morphed into a hot international trend, and something that can tiptoe its way around government regulations. Our reporter, Scott Haas, is in Switzerland searching out the latest in Swiss munchaceuticals.
I'm standing here in Rettershin, in the central part of Switzerland, the canton of Zurich, on a farm called Bettlihof, and I'm here with Bettina Springer, who is a farmer who makes a product called night milk. Bettina, thank you very much for taking the time to meet with me.
Hi, Scott.
And tell me about this night milk. What is it?
Well, night milk contains about 5 times more melatonin than ordinary milk.
And melatonin is what? For people who don't know what it is.
Well, melatonin is a substance which is produced by the body. It's a hormone, also known as sleeping hormone.
So these cows naturally produce more melatonin? I mean, did you find these cows somewhere? They just were melatonin-producing cows?
No. the secret is that...
Yes, there's a secret. What's the secret?
Well, it's not actually a secret. It's just the fact that the body produces melatonin is circulating in the blood only at night. So what we do is we milk the cows at night when it's totally dark.
So if I were to have 16 cows of my own in the state of Vermont, and I were to milk them from midnight until 4 a.m., would they produce higher levels of melatonin if I milked them in the dark as well?
Well, all cows do, so you have...
So there's nothing unique about these 16 cows. It's your method that's unique.
No, the cows are ordinary brown Swiss cows and friendly.
Just friendly, good cows. The part that confuses me is why not just take a melatonin tablet? I mean, you take a melatonin tablet, and like of 1 milligram, and it has the same effect, maybe even a stronger effect.
Maybe even a stronger effect, but it isn't natural. I mean, the melatonin which we have in our milk is 100% natural. The cows themselves produce it. And that what convinces me, because it's a natural thing, so you can't get any overdose or anything. You don't have to worry. And in fact, melatonin in tablets is not allowed in Switzerland.
It's not legal?
No.
Uh-huh. So in other words, the only source of melatonin in a high form is from this milk.
Yes.
Oh, so that's very unique. Now, we've met the cows on the outside. Can you take me inside the operation where you work with the cows?
Sure, because
Thank you. It's
all empty at the time.
It's all empty. Well, it's right. It's midday. It's a very strong smell of cows.
So with these lamps, we have about the same amount of light which you would have in an office or something, just because a stable which is built for 50 years ago doesn't have very big windows or something like that, to avoid that any light enters the stable during the day, and especially in the early morning in summer when it's already light, we have these.
Oh, to cover the windows, these wonderful big cardboard, that's wonderful.
Oh, that's which we put in front of all the windows.
That's fantastic. That's great. Low technology. I'm here with Uli Budakoffer from the Swiss Federal Dairy Research Station, and Uli is a scientist with the Federal Milk Research Branch. Is this all just a good story? I mean, is this true?
You have an increase in melatonin where you can really measure it. But the level you have is not the same as you will find in the medicaments you will buy in the States.
How much, if I take 1 milligram of a melatonin tablet, and I understand that melatonin tablets are not legal in Switzerland, but let's say they were. If I were to take 1 milligram of melatonin tablet, how much milk is equal to that 1 melatonin?
I have to ask Bettina, how much you have 15 picograms per milliliter or per liter?
Per milliliter. Yeah. The level of melatonin in our milk is much lower than the melatonin in which you take if you're taking tablets. But I consider it's a hormone, and as we know, hormones do react in a very low level.
So you've just handed me this very beautiful blue bottle, which almost looks medicinal in form, and it shows a very content sleeping woman on here, and it says night milk, and it naturally contains melatonin. It's even organic. All right, so we're going to open the bottle. You're going to open the bottle. It looks like ordinary milk, so should I just have a little sip on the side? Nothing bad will happen. Well, it tastes like very delicious Swiss milk. It's whole milk, right?
Yes, we want to keep the product as natural as possible.
It has that wonderful sweet, nutty, fresh taste that a Swiss milk has that I prize so much. But if I were to take a glass of the night milk next to a glass of Swiss milk, ordinary Swiss milk, I would not taste the difference.
No, you wouldn't.
But I will feel the difference, perhaps, possibly, if I have, a lot of this.
Yes.
Well, listen, Bettina, I wanted to thank you very much for taking the time to educate me about the night milk. I really appreciate it, and I feel very tired. I feel very, very sleepy as I speak to you. And I'm sure it's the milk. But more importantly, what I love about the milk is it makes me think back to when I was a child, that my mother was really right, that, if I have a glass of milk and I can't sleep, that maybe a glass of milk would help me through the night. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm so tired, I haven't slept a wink. I'm so tired, my mind is on the blink.
Scott Haas is the author of Are We There Yet? Perfect Family Vacations and Other Fantasies. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is about a handy piece of food science from Harold McGee's book on food and cooking. Here's the question. What's the secret to foaming milk without steam or a special gadget? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/
Super Target. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the secret to foaming milk without steam? I'm going to turn all of you into baristas. Now, the answer comes from Harold McGee's book on food science, On Food and Cooking. And the answer is shake and bake. Now, McGee says you put cold milk into a jar, shake it hard until it's doubled in volume, takes about 20 seconds, stabilize the foam by uncovering the jar and microwaving it on high for 30 seconds. Now, here's why it works. According to McGee, milk foams because of its proteins. Now, its foam is really fragile because those proteins are pretty sparse. Now, to make matters even trickier, some of those proteins resist the process. But if you shake them up and immediately heat them to 160 degrees, they hold that puff for a while. And by the way, the best milk for foaming is very fresh and fortified with added protein, which usually means low-fat or non-fat milk. Who knew? A jar and a microwave.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me.
Lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Michelle on the line. Hi, Michelle. Do you have a question?
I do. I have a question for you about rose hips and how to use them. My mother was a natural food fanatic in the 70s, and I grew up with this and hearing about rose hips. I have these beautiful rugosa roses in my yard. They make these giant rose hips, probably silver dollar size.
Wow.
Exactly. And it's a 20-foot hedgerow, so there's lots of them.
you could quarter the market on rose hips.
I'm telling you, and I don't know what to do with them.
You know, maybe we should explain to people when we say rose hips what we mean. And these are when you talk about rugosa roses, these are almost what you would call wild roses?
Yes.
Yeah, they're not like a tea rose. They don't have that kind of tulip shaped flower. But this is the pod at the base of the flower, right?
Uh-huh.
And after the petals disappear, this pod, which will be green, ripens, and when it turns red and you can easily press the sides of it, you have ripe rose hips. Now I haven't had them in a long time, but I remember they tasted almost a little bit like apricots.
They're very tart, from what I remember.
Right, but they have a real fruity quality.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay, what do you do with them? Well, there's the famous rose hip jelly. Have you ever tried that?
I haven't, simply because I don't really know when to harvest them. That's my biggest question.
This is the thing. They should turn reddish color, okay? Mm-hmm. And they should, when you press them gently on the sides, they should have some give.
Okay.
And often they need to go through a first frost.
Well, see, now that's what all the books told me, but by the time we had our first frost, they were all wrinkled and shrivelly looking and didn't look nice anymore.
Yeah, I think then, I've never seen them at that stage used. They usually then are sort of over the hill.
That's
now,
right.
It would still be worthwhile maybe throwing them, I mean, you'd have, because they're high in vitamin C and other vitamins, I mean, you could throw them into a simple jelly mixture and see what you get. You know, I do a small quantity. This is the idea that you take those rose hips, you cut off the top and bottom because there's like a little thing at the top that's sort of hairy, right? And you take them off the stem at the other end and you'd cut them in half with a scissor and then you'd mix them. Like if you have a pound of rose hips, you maybe want 1.5-2 pounds of green apples, tart apples. And the idea is that you cook that together with some water because the apples are going to make a natural jelly. The apples make the gel. You know, they have that natural quality. And you strain that because the seeds of the rose hips can get really bitter. So once that's soft, you just run it through a strainer. Okay. And then you add sugar to taste to that. All right. Simmer it another 20 minutes maybe to melt in the sugar. And then you put it into what they call a jelly bag. And a jelly bag could really just be a kitchen towel that doesn't smell of detergent or whatever.
Right.
you know, like a linen towel that's clean that you suspend over a bowl, because what you want to do is just have that drip so you just get the clear liquid from that combination. And once you get that clear liquid, you put that into sterilized jars and you seal the top. And you've got jelly.
There's enough natural pectin in the apples.
You got
it. Need to add any.
That's right. And that's why it's so nice to use the apple instead of the pectin. And if your rose hip, now, one of the things, when you cut into that rose hip before you start the whole process, give it a sniff. You know, see if it smells nice, because they are dry. They are on the shriveled side, but they may be very concentrated and very appealing. I do a small batch and see what you get.
Okay.
And if they work, you've got great Christmas gifts.
Indeed.
And next time when they turn red and plump, forget the frost business. Just pick them.
Well, now I'll know.
Yeah. Yeah. But who knows? Nobody ever tells you this stuff.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, you brought back great memories. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye now.
I grew up taking rosehip tea, rosehip vitamins. They were a big deal and supposedly really great for you. Anyway, you can reach us 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up next. We've got Susan calling from Bolton, Vermont. Hey, Susan, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I would like to talk about schmaltz.
As in chicken fat.
Yes, ma'am.
What brought schmaltz into your life?
Well, I have a small farm here in Vermont, and we've been raising chickens for our freezers for a couple of years. This year, the man who does the slaughtering for us and packaging for us rendered all of this chicken fat and put it into containers for me in the freezer. And he doesn't speak English very well. And I had a hard time figuring out what it was and what to do with it. And then my sister said, I think that's schmaltz. And it's yellow gold, you know?
Oh, yeah. Everything. Oh, yeah.
And so I started to cook with it a little bit, using it as to melt it before I make like a chicken dish or that kind of thing.
Right.
It's wonderful in chicken soup especially. I've been online. I can't find a whole lot of information about it. So I wanted to know just what I have and what can I do with it and how long will it keep and those kinds of things.
Well, let's start with the last question first. It'll keep in the freezer probably for close to 9 months.
Okay, great.
As long as it's really well sealed, you know, in a heavy container and that kind of thing. And now, you know, it's saturated fat. So this is one of the reasons why schmaltz, I think, went out of fashion. And it's very much part of traditional Middle Europe and Eastern European cooking. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it tastes, I mean, chicken fat, duck fat, goose fat, and pork fat, they are all the kings of the fat world. I mean, they taste delicious. And you can use a tablespoon of schmaltz on a baked potato, right?
Oh.
And, you know, just mash it in, or even a teaspoon. It is going to taste so fabulous. But one of the great, you know, you have chickens. Do you save the livers?
Yes, we do.
And I would imagine your chickens haven't been fed all the stuff that you don't want to eat and all that stuff.
No. We're not entirely organic, but we're pretty close.
Right. So what I'm thinking is those chicken livers are great, and there is a classic traditional Jewish dish, which is, you know, chopped chicken livers.
Uh-huh.
And the way that's made is that you take the livers and you saute them in a very generous amount of that schmaltz,
mm-hmm,
with a bit of diced onion. Some people like a lot of onion. And when they're just firm but still a little pink at the center, you cool that down and then you can puree it or you can mash it or whatever. And my mouth is watering as I'm saying this. And you serve, you know, you keep it in the fridge. You can cover the top of it with a little more schmaltz. And it holds for 3 or 4 days. And if you have never had this spread on anything that doesn't move too fast, you haven't lived. It's chopped chicken livers, and it's, you know, call it a pate, but it's just fabulous. And a ton of onions. Some people add garlic. Other people add other stuff. But anytime you want flavorful fat, use the schmaltz. It can replace butter. It can replace pork fat and, you know, fried potatoes in it. You think you've died and gone to heaven. But even, you know, one of the things that's really delicious is just saute a chicken breast. And again, 1 tablespoon.
Okay.
And of course, matzo ball soup.
Well, you know, I've made chicken liver pate from the livers.
Right.
And I've used the schmaltz for other things, but I haven't put the two of them together. So
that's my next project.
I'll do that.
Yeah, traditional Jewish dish. And it's food for kings.
Well, I've got so much of it. I have I think, 12 pints of it in my freezer.
You should give it away as a holiday gift.
That's exactly what I was going to say. In fact, I gave some to my girlfriend's mom. She's a Jewish lady, and she just was over the moon.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, this goes back to an old ad for rye bread in New York. You don't have to be Jewish to love schmaltz. I think anybody who loves good food, just tell them, instead of butter.
Okay, I will.
Instead of butter, on bread, sprinkle it with salt. Incredible.
Oh, yummy. I'll try that.
Hey, great. Hey, Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
I just have to stand up for the fats. Yeah, they're not good for us, but a little bit of a really delicious fat. Oh, guys, it goes such a long way. And that's what freezers are for. It's to save that stuff. Well, you can call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Gloria on the line from Stillwater, Minnesota. Hey, Gloria, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I had a bumper crop of nasturtiums this year in my garden, and I had read that the pods were very similar to capers.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I went out there and took a bunch of the pods. I've got about a pint of them that I pickled in a brine of just some vinegar and salt.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm kind of wondering what to do with these. They're much bigger than a typical caper. They're the size of a large pea.
Right, right,
and
yeah.
I'm just wondering about some recipes that would sort of, you know, showcase them so I can sort of show off a little from my garden surprise people.
Well, first of all, tuna salad.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, your typical tuna salad is absolutely delicious with capers in it.
Yeah, they have a nice peppery taste.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and if I were to put a tuna salad, let's say, you know, in a bed of lettuce, and I'd sprinkle extra capers on the top. The other thing is that they're wonderful with any fish dish. So for argument's sake, let's say you have a piece of salmon, you saute it, you know, in a pan, you take a little maybe white wine or whatever to deglaze the pan, you know, get up all those nice crusty bits, you stir in the capers, cook them for a minute or two, and then just spoon that over the fish.
Ooh, that sounds good.
And that peppery, vinegary flavor and that little bit of crunch is going to be wonderful. And that works with almost any fish you can imagine.
Oh, that sounds very good.
A classic Southern Italian Mediterranean thing to do with them is that you chop them with garlic and rosemary and mix that with a little bit of olive oil and black pepper and rub it over anything. You can rub that over chicken, over lamb, over beef, you know, over fish. And the idea is you can marinate it overnight if you want, but then you pan saute, you grill, or you roast.
Oh, those are two of my favorite seasonings.
Well, you put that together because, you know, the caper is like a little exclamation point in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, again, to show them off, if I were doing, let's say, a roast pork with that,
mm-hmm.
I would sprinkle some of the uncooked capers right from the jar over that as I present it and let people get that real fresh, bright flavor from it, too.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I'll try some of those.
You're inspiring me to grow nasturtiums next summer.
And they were so easy.
I know that, you know, I kill everything, but my nasturtiums always survive. It's amazing.
Yeah. I'm going to put in a bigger crop next year, actually.
Well, you know, the other thing is you can jar them the way you did in little jars and great gifts.
Yeah,
house gifts,
that's what
that
I'm
kind
thinking.
Of stuff. Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking.
Hey, thank you, Gloria.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. For food lovers, this is the year of the reference book. And one publication alone makes that statement valid. In fact, this isn't merely a book. This is a milestone. I'm talking about the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. Two volumes covering everything from adulteration to zombies. Now, we have the encyclopedia's editor-in-chief, Professor Andrew Smith, on the phone. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Lynn.
There are 800-some entries in the encyclopedia. How did you set the parameters? How did you figure out where you were going to begin and where you were going to end?
The main problem, of course, was space. It may sound like, you know, two volumes and 1,500 pages is a lot of space, but mm-hmm. actually, to do the job completely, it probably would have taken another 10 volumes. So the real problem was how do you eliminate things that some of us might have wanted to incorporate in. So we started with brainstorming. What would we like in there? And there were 10 of us, the associate editors and the staff of Oxford University Press, and we brainstormed it. We sent the list out to a large number of people, and we actually ended up with about 3,000 potential entries. And then the process was going through and saying what's important mm-hmm. and what's not.
You know, one of the biggest problems with books like this is getting it right. It comes down to knowing what you don't know. How did you validate this information? I mean, did you use peer review as they do in the sciences?
Well, every entry was reviewed at least three times by different people, in some cases because some of the editors didn't have expertise in a particular topic, we ask outside people to come in and review entries. But yes, that was a problem. And some of the entries, it was obvious. We went to the person who had written the academic book or the academic article or the dissertation on the subject, and they were the ones that were easy. But probably about half the entries, there was no obvious person to write it. And so it meant reaching it to new voices, which was very good. A lot of people, the first time that they have ever published something, they're published in the encyclopedia. And going to old-time people who've been around for a long time that have a general background that would be willing to take on new topics. So, but we don't make any claim that this is the answer to all the issues. In fact, quite the opposite. We think this is the statement of what we know today, and we really ask our readers to respond to us and tell us what's not in there that should be in there, and if they think that there's a mistake, let us know, and we'll make corrections and changes in it.
Were there any for you, because you're a food historian, you've covered so much of American history in your work, were there any aha moments or surprises?
I really thought I knew American food history when I started working on the project, which I guess is without a big ego, you would never have gotten into it. I must admit that there were very few entries that I didn't find something that I was surprised at, and some of it was just trivia, but others were just crucial things that I just never thought about. My approach is as an historian, but we had anthropologists and we had geographers and we had sociologists. And we had food studies people, and we had chefs making, contributing to the encyclopedia, and each of them came with different perspectives. And from my standpoint, that was what made this really exciting to work on.
Andrew Smith, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Food historian Dr. Andrew Smith is editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from comedian Rita Rudner. She said, "I was a vegetarian until I started leaning toward the sun." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. You'll also find details on our spring trip to Italy on that very same website. Additional support for our program comes from Starbucks, collecting books and toys at neighborhood locations for this year's Holiday Angels Joy Drive. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. The Night Milk piece was produced by Lindsay Kruftel. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.